Each side of the arena, 16-year-old Jake Howell took a long drag in the joint before flicking it at his buddy, David Kane. The two teenagers were sitting on the private beach located directly behind the Tanaka Lagoons Arena. 50 yards north, the concrete seawall of the access canal stretched out into the Pacific like a highway off-ramp.
Cop!
David buried the joint in the sand as a security guard crossed behind them.
Asshole, that's not a cop. Look what you made me do.
Jake snickered, rolling on his back. The security guard turned.
You boys shouldn't be back here.
Jake smiled.
We're waiting for our parents, officer.
Move, or I'll have you moved.
Jake stood, rubbing the back of his shaved head with his middle finger. The two boys followed the beach south past the arena until the guard was out of sight.
Hey, assholes!
They turned to see David's cousin, Doug, running toward them. He held up a crowbar.
Come on, I found a way in!
Jonas watched as the crimson glow of the setting sun faded behind the brightly lit arena. From the open bay window, he heard the crowd noise escalate as the underwater tank lights flickered on, turning the dark lagoon waters a bright teal. He turned to face one of the technicians. Is she still in the canal?
Yeah, but she stopped pounding the gate about an hour ago. Probably has a headache.
Jonas put the binoculars to his face. There were no lights in the canal, making it impossible to see the Meg underwater. He turned to his left, watching Manny and another assistant struggle to hook an immense side of beef onto the chain of the A-frame. Moments later, the outdoor lights were dimmed, and the deep baritone recording of timpani drums began, ushering the visitors to their seats. Mac took a seat next to Jonas.
I spoke to my guy. I'll have the transmitter by tomorrow morning. Here comes your fish.
An enormous phosphorescent mass glided into the lagoon. The three teens listened for the crowd's crescendo before prying open the fire door. They jogged past souvenir stands and had already entered the outdoor arena before the first guard noticed the alarm bells ringing. In the southern end of the lagoon, rising waves slapped against the plexiglass barriers. Jake pointed to the concrete structure supporting the A-frame.
See that door? It leads to an underwater observation room down below. How do you know? Saw it on TV. Doug, give me the crowbar.
Jake led David and his cousin to the steel door. They stood behind him, shielding his movements from the crowd while he pried open the lock. Jonas focused his binoculars on the pallid beast as it viciously tore the remains of its meal from the chain. As he pulled back to locate Manny, something caught his eye. He trained the glasses on the observation room door.
What is it? Mac asked.
I don't know. Probably nothing. I thought I saw the door leading down into the observation area swing open. Jonas handed him the binoculars.
Hard to tell from this angle. You want to take a look?
Yeah, maybe we'd better. The teens ran down the stairs and into the corridor.
Whoa, Jake, check this out!
The three boys stood before the underwater bay windows, staring into the depths of the lagoon. David pressed his face against the glass.
Where's the fucking shark? Gone, asswipe, the show's over. Bullshit,
Jake said.
This show's about to begin.
He banged against the Lexan glass, the others following suit.
Here, Angel, here, girl!
Jonas followed Mac down the concrete steps of the upper deck. He looked up to see the Megalodon glide slowly back toward the canal. As they made their way to the southern end of the outdoor arena, the creature suddenly turned.
Here she comes!
Doug yelled.
Hey, Kane, watch this!
Jake pulled his baggy Junko shorts and boxers down and pressed his bare buttocks against the window. David and Doug fell down laughing as the Meg accelerated toward the viewing window. Jake ducked beneath the window frame, laughing as he rolled on the damp concrete floor. The creature slowed, then banked sharply, slapping its great caudal fin hard against the reinforced glass. The Lexan rattled within its frame.
Hey, Jake, check out this sign! No movement while the Megalodon is in the area!
Jake stood, pressing his face against the glass. The creature was circling, its back arched.
I think she wants to play!
Jake and Doug banged on the glass, while David took out a can of black spray paint, laughing hysterically. Mac led Jonas through a crowd congregating around the southern end of the lagoon. Instead of leaving, people seemed to be moving toward the tank, jostling to get a better view.
Jonas, what's going on?
I don't know. Something's drawn Angel back into the main tank.
Oh, shit. Look at the door. Somebody broke in, all right. You better get security down here.
David stood back and admired his handiwork.
Here she comes!
All three boys stood by the window, wide-eyed, adrenaline pumping. The Megalodon accelerated toward them like a Boeing 747.
Now!
The juveniles dropped to the floor. Losing its prey once more, the creature slowed, swiping the glass barrier with its snout and upper row of teeth and gums.
Oh, man, what a rush,
Jake said. David stood, then stopped laughing. Just above the freshly painted words, "Bite me," a blazing slate-colored eye was staring at him. The Meg turned, moving off into the lagoon. Jake and Doug stood, ready to play again.
No, wait, David said. Maybe we ought to go.
You go. I gotta do this at least one more time. You in, Doug?
Hell yeah. Come on, man. Don't be a pussy.
They started banging. David watched the creature approach. He felt his hands trembling. What had started out as fun and games was becoming dangerous. Still, he didn't want to chicken out.
This is it. The last time, okay?
Fine, Jake said.
Let's wait until the last second. Wait until you see her ugly-ass eyes.
The three boys readied themselves, hearts pounding, staring into the charging face of the 62,000-pound monster.
Now!
The boys ducked below the window, laughing. The megalodon struck the Lexan window like a locomotive plowing through kindling. Shards of glass and bone-chilling water exploded into the corridor as the creature's snout and upper jaw slammed into the back wall, knocking out a dozen teeth. David and his cousin registered the white torpedo a split second before its crushing girth drove them backward against the concrete wall. An icy torrent lifted Jake off his feet. He squeezed his eyes shut and curled up as his body was tossed within the corridor. Jonas ran down the steps as a deafening crash rocked the stairwell. Racing down the corridor, he was greeted by an incoming wall of frothing water. He turned and ducked, the 8-foot wave pummeling him against the concrete floor, sliding him back toward the stairwell. Before he realized what was happening, the flow ceased. He opened his eyes, lying on his stomach in a pool of water, gasping to regain his breath. Yellow lights flashed through the corridor. Jonas stood, dripping wet. The emergency doors had activated, sealing off the viewing area from the rest of the corridor. He sloshed over to the steel door, looking through its 18-inch porthole. Angel, what have you done? What he saw made him nauseous. Jake's lungs were on fire, his limbs like lead weights. He felt his body floating up from the floor and opened his eyes. The image jolted him awake as if he'd been struck by lightning. He opened his mouth to scream, gagging on seawater as the cavernous maw surrounded him. Thrashing about, he paddled and kicked furiously, slipping out of the monster's closing jaws, trying to surface. Jake's head struck the ceiling. The realization of his predicament sent a surge of panic through his limbs. Through blurred vision, he searched the flooded corridor, only to find himself pinned against the back wall. The megalodon pushed forward, homing in on the vibrations. Jake felt his body being sucked backward in a vacuum of water. With nowhere to maneuver, he ducked instinctively as the 9-foot maw jutted forward and clamped shut over his head. In pitch darkness, he gasped a putrid breath as the water momentarily drained away from his face. He gagged, then registered his own muffled screams within the creature's mouth as unseen scalpels sliced and pulverized his body into mincemeat. Through foamy swirls of pink, Jonas saw the creature shake its imposing head, retracting its body from the underwater viewing room.
God damn it!
Jonas ran up the stairs, emerging outside in time to see Angel surface, the remains of a lower body held aloft in her jaws. Screams rent the night. News crews jostled for camera angles, nearly pushing one another into the tank. Rising to the surface, Angel shook her head to and fro like a mad dog, tearing apart the carcass as her twisting upper torso sent great swells in every direction. The beast disappeared, submerging somewhere beneath the floating pool of blood and mangled limbs. Then the hyperextended jaws rose majestically from the tank and, in one horrific bite, engulfed the remains from below. Change of plans. Western Pacific. Positioned parallel to each other on two enormous hydraulic ramps at the Goliath's stern were the sister submersibles Prometheus and Epimetheus. The identical cigar-shaped vessels, both painted white with red trim, were 68 feet long, with 16-foot beams and 5-foot-high conning towers. In contrast to the somewhat barren dorsal surface, the subs' bellies contained an array of high-tech gadgets, the centerpiece being a spherical observation pod. From within this 8-foot structure, a single operator could manipulate a pair of robotic arms, cameras, lights, and a vacuum hose for gathering samples along the bottom. Terry and Maceo watched from the stern as the hydraulic ramp supporting the Epimetheus rolled into position beneath a massive winch along the Goliath's transom. Benedict Singer joined them.
"The late arrival of our subs forces a change of plans," Benedict said. "The air purifiers and scrubbers on board the Benthos must be replaced before carbon dioxide levels become too high. The Epimetheus will descend immediately with supplies and a partial replacement crew, returning topside in 2 days with our A-team. The rest of B-Team, along with myself, will descend aboard her sister ship, the Prometheus, following their return. We're scheduled to begin a week-long mission in the Abyss to deploy no less than 3 of your Unis robots.
I shall inform Jumpstick, Maceo said, admiring the Epimetheus as she rolled by.
Tell me, the inscription beneath the sub's names.
Resurgam, I shall rise again.
And the vessel's names? Terry asked. Benedict smiled, relishing the opportunity to pontificate.
According to Greek mythology, the Titan god Epimetheus was charged with distributing gifts to all of the animals in the world, gifts necessary for survival. Unfortunately, Epimetheus ran out of gifts by the time it was humanity's turn, and so his brother, Prometheus, stole the sun's energy and gave it to man. Zeus was so angered that he had Prometheus chained to a mountain, where vultures tore away at his liver for 1,000 years.
Prometheus means forethought. Epimetheus, afterthought.
Will the Epimetheus be returning with the information Jumpstick requires?
Those are my orders, Maceo, but I expect you'll be disappointed. I doubt the Benthos records will reveal any more than the Goliaths.
Benedict Searer, please contact the control room at once.
Celeste's metallic announcement echoed across the deck.
Excuse me.
Benedict removed his walkie-talkie, moving away from them as he spoke. Maceo watched the man's face closely. Something is wrong. Terry leaned over the rail, watching a team of divers ride the Epimetheus into the sea.
Dad, how much do you trust Singer?
You are suspicious?
I think he's hiding something. Why would a billionaire energy mogul be so interested in bailing out the Tanaka Institute, let alone take on the Unis contract?
I asked Benedict the same question when we first met. He claimed to have found himself drawn to the Megalodon's sheer power and grace. He says he became challenged with the idea of building a fleet of vessels capable of exploring the creature's trench.
And you believed him?
A GTI has invested more than $1 billion for sea exploration.
Benedict returned, looking grim.
We have a situation. There's been a terrible accident at the Tanaka Lagoon. The creature attacked and killed 3 teenage boys who had broken into the viewing corridor.
Terry saw her father go pale.
Chaos abounds, Maceo, and the media are circling. As president of the Institute, I suggest you return with Celeste to Monterey at once. Terry can remain on board to obtain the information for Jumpstick.
Maceo's knees buckled.
Dad!
Terry grabbed his arm, feeling him shaking in convulsions. Benedict reached for him as he collapsed on deck. 4 hours later, Celeste joined Benedict on the uppermost deck of the Goliath, beneath a sea of stars.
Doctor says the old man should be okay. We'll leave for Monterey at first light.
Such a beautiful night.
Benedict stared up at the twinkling sky.
Funny how things work out sometimes, isn't it?
We sail where fate directs. Still, I'm concerned with our timetable. Jumpstick and the Americans are already suspicious. If we remain in the trench for more than a month, they may investigate themselves. We can't risk the Goliath being boarded.
How long will you be able to keep Terry on board without arousing suspicion?
She'll leave only after you persuade the information out of Jonas Taylor.
A few days, perhaps a week at the most.
Benedict smiled.
Festina lente, Celeste. Make haste slowly.
Celeste leaned her head against her mentor's chest, running her fingers along his stomach.
I do find him rather attractive. Does this make you jealous?
Benedict grabbed her by the hair, yanking back hard, forcing her to look into his piercing emerald eyes.
Never forget your place.
Prostitie!
Benedict released her.
Gain Taylor's trust and obtain the information. But if he suspects the truth, kill him.
Differences of opinion. Tanaka Oceanographic Institute. The late afternoon shower sent ripples across the aqua-green waters of the Tanaka Lagoon. Jonas watched the rain from his third-floor office. The arena was deserted. The facility closed, pending the results of the police investigation. Every few minutes, a hollow, metallic boom echoed across the man-made lake.
That's 3. If she sticks to her pattern, she'll circle back into the main tank and wait another 10 minutes before having another go at it.
As if on cue, the 8-foot wake rolled in from the canal, a white blur gliding into the lagoon. The intercom buzzed.
Miss Singer and Mr. Tanaka are ready to see you.
Jonas left his office, walking quickly down the corridor to Celeste Singer's office. The secretary gave him an antiseptic smile.
Go ahead inside, they're waiting.
Maceo greeted him as he entered the suite. Jonas hadn't seen him since he had returned earlier that morning. He looked as if he had aged 10 years.
Maceo, how do you feel?
I'll survive.
Come, take a seat. We have much to discuss.
Celeste emerged from her private washroom wearing a black skirt and white blouse, her platinum blonde hair pulled up in a tight bun.
Jonas, darling, I'm so glad to see you again.
She kissed him on the cheek, then took her place at the head of an oval conference table, where a well-built gentleman in his late 30s was already seated. Steely-eyed, all business. A legal pad and miniature tape recorder sat ready on the table in front of him.
Jonas, this gentleman is Lee Jurelsmann, a partner with the law firm of Kravitz, Jurelsmann, Kiras, and Pasquale. Since we can anticipate getting hit with a lawsuit from the parents of the dead teenagers, I thought it best to be prepared.
Professor, I'm well aware of the class-action lawsuit you and the Tanaka Institute had to endure over the last 18 months. Now, I want to begin by putting your mind at ease regarding this incident. The three teens involved were juveniles with rap sheets as long as your arm. We know they didn't pay to enter the arena, and we have a dozen eyewitnesses who saw them break into the locked facility where the attack took place. We're looking at a clear case of contributory negligence and assumption of risk,
which is just out of defense, Celeste interrupted. Those little bastards not only trespassed, but their actions cost our company more than $1 million in damages and lost revenues. I told Lee I want to go after their parents and countersue.
Of course, that's your decision, Lee said. Now, we are looking at a breach of duty of supervision, at the very least a negligent supervision claim.
Jonas shook his head. These boys paid with their lives, isn't that enough?
No, Celeste said. You lost $200 million before GTI took over because you weren't prepared. There are dozens of attorneys out there circling like sharks, waiting to take a bite out of the Tanaka cash cow. I say we go after them.
Jonas looked at his father-in-law.
Maceo, what do you think?
Maceo agrees, Celeste answered. Lee, let's talk spin control. I'm scheduled to address the media in another hour to announce the reopening of the arena tomorrow morning. I want you to join me. Prepare a few carefully worded remarks about how these juveniles broke into our facility. Mention their rap sheet and how they infuriated our little angel, inciting her to attack.
Lee wrote furiously on a legal pad.
I can do that, Celeste, but I think we should be cautious.
Forget cautious. You can't win on the defense. You have to attack.
Is all this really necessary?
Maceo asked. Ticket sales have jumped since the incident.
We're sold out through August.
Celeste, there's something more important, much more urgent we need to discuss, Jonas said.
Lee stood. Let me give you some privacy. I need time to make some notes anyway.
Jonas shook Lee's hand, waiting until the door swung closed before he began.
Celeste, we've got a major problem, and I'm not talking about any lawsuit. You've read my report and proposal. The Meg has been trying to break out. Unless we do something quickly, she'll escape.
Подождите, wait, slow down. Did you say escape? Jonas, darling, have you even conducted the visual inspection of the outer hinges?
No, not yet. I had planned on doing it yesterday, but the police had other ideas. We'll get to it first thing tomorrow morning.
And what does your plan to reinforce the doors involve?
Again, it's all in my proposal. The construction work would take place along the outside of the gateway.
Pilings would be driven into the seafloor to prevent the doors from opening. Then a 4-foot wall of concrete would be poured in sections along the outer doors and pilings.
And the lowest bid you received was $3 million?
$3 million, too.
Angel will also have to be doped up for at least 10 days to complete the work. You'll probably have to shut down the arena.
Celeste glanced down at the proposal.
I think I want to hear more about this before I just say yes. Maceo, may I steal your son-in-law for a business dinner?
Sorry, I can't, Jonas said. Too much work.
It's all right, Maceo said. I'll take care of things here.
Excellent.
Celeste hit a button on her phone.
Margaret, have my car brought around.
Jonas gave Maceo a long, hard look. The maitre d' showed them to a table facing the water. Celeste ordered drinks, then excused herself to use the ladies' room. Jonas looked around the Victorian dining room, noticing couples smiling and laughing together. He ran the tips of his fingers above the candle's flames, staring at his wedding band. He thought of Terry, and his heart ached for her. He had been caught off guard the other day when she confessed her unhappiness. Were things really that bad? How could he have missed the signs? You miss the signs because you're selfish. He tried to recall the last time he and Terry had laughed together, or had made love when it hadn't seemed an obligation. When was the last time they had spent time away together from work? Jonas felt a lump in his throat. His obsession with the megalodon had made him blind. He detected Celeste by her jasmine scent moments before she brushed past him to take her seat. She smiled at him, the candlelight dancing in her eyes. This one's poison in a million-dollar wrapper.
I'm tired, she cooed, slipping her sandals off. My feet could use a massage.
She ran her toes up Jonas's pant leg.
So, what are you hungry for? I bet they have great lobster here.
Stop. She smiled at the brush-off. Celeste, this is supposed to be a business dinner.
It is. I'm working on employee morale.
He pushed her foot away again. Employee morale, that's a laugh. The last time you blew through town, you showed nothing but contempt for our entire staff.
Not you.
She drained her martini.
Maybe you can help me to mellow?
I doubt it. I think you get off on controlling people. The words seemed to affect her. She gazed out the window, lost in thought.
You're right, Jonas. I can be harsh. Or daring to do me to want.
What does that mean?
One of Benedict's favorite expressions. Let them hate so long as they fear. I only know one way to do things, and that's the way my guardian has taught me. I've spent more than half my life being groomed by Benedict to take over his organization when he retires. He's given me a set of, how do you say, brass balls. I'm his partner and confidant, the son he'll never have, the mistress he'll never marry.
How is it that you and Benedict met?
My father was a Russian nuclear engineer. He and Benedict met at a seminar at Oxford in 1970 and became friends. My mother was a beautiful Russian woman. Benedict actually introduced her to my father. I was born in England, but my father moved us to Bielorussia when I was 8 to take a position at Chernobyl.
She looked up at him, tears welling in her eyes.
April 26th, 1986 was the last day I saw my father alive. My mother and I were relocated after the accident, but Benedict truly saved us. He moved us into a small apartment in Moscow. He would visit us when he came to the city on business, which was frequent back then. A short time later, Benedict introduced my mother to another man, a powerful member of the Politburo, who many felt would become the new Minister of the Interior. They began seeing each other, discreetly. The man was married with a family. 2 days before my 11th birthday, I came home from school and found someone had shot my mother and her Politburo lover while they were making love in her bed.
Did they ever find out who did it?
I have my suspicions. I remember it being a huge political scandal. But my bigger concern at the time was trying to survive on the streets of Moscow, only 12 years old, with no family or money. Benedict found me 8 months later. I was working as a prostitute. He sent me to America to a boarding school. On vacations, I'd return to one of his homes in California, though he was usually gone, flying to one country or another on business. Then, when I turned 14, everything changed. I was home for summer break, just sitting outside by the pool, when I saw him staring at me from inside the guest house. At the time, I had no idea what he was doing, but I remember liking the fact that I finally had his attention. I even teased him, removing my bikini top, rubbing oil over my breasts. We never spoke of what happened, but he pulled me out of school to travel with him around the world. He hired a woman to tutor me. Her name was Anne Barry. I remember her having one of those real twangy Tennessee accents. Anyway, Anne traveled with us everywhere. At first I thought she might be Benedict's mistress. Then one night, just after my 15th birthday, Anne slips into my room and crawls into bed with me.
What did you do?
Well, I certainly wasn't into women, but I was confused. Anne was the first person who had shown me any affection since my parents had died. She desired me and was gentle, and I needed the warmth of another human being, so I let her use me. Anyway, those little conjugal visits went on until Benedict found us naked in bed together.
What did he do?
Benedict's an opportunist, and he never lets his emotions impair his judgment. He was furious at Anne, but decided to use her to teach me one of life's most important lessons, how to deal with one's enemies. The next morning we boarded his private jet to fly to England. On the way over, he had one of his personal staff, a former KGB agent, take Anne into a private compartment and work her pretty good.
In front of you?
No, Sergei liked his privacy. Probably gave Anne the first heterosexual experience she ever had. Halfway over the Atlantic, the Muscovite brought her out, her arms bound behind her back, bruises everywhere. Benedict pulled a gag from her mouth and told her to apologize to me. I'll never forget the look in her eyes, a frightened, insane animal. The next thing I know, the jet drops to 3,000 feet, and Sergei's opening the outer door. Benedict grabbed Anne by the hair and said to me, "Celeste, my dear, always remember to keep your enemies close so that you can dispose of them properly when the time is right." Then he stepped back and kicked her right out of his jet.
My God, he murdered her just like that?
Is she playing me again? I can't tell. Yes, Jonas, just like that. Cold, calculated, and efficient. That's my guardian. The truth is, I was flattered. It was the third time Benedict had come to my aid. As far as I was concerned, Anne had crossed the line and deserved to die. I even remember running to the window, hoping to catch a glimpse of her body smashing against the water. Then I gave Benedict a hug.
What? Tell me what you're thinking.
Jonas exhaled. I don't know what to think. I guess you've had a pretty twisted childhood.
Perhaps. But is this not better than a twisted adulthood?
Nevajna. She drained her drink.
It turns out the real reason Benedict was so angry at Anne was because he wanted me for himself. He came to me two nights later. From that moment on, our relationship changed. I became his trusted confidant, and he realized that I had not only inherited my mother's looks, but my father's intelligence. Benedict became my personal tutor in the school of the real world. By day, he taught me how to be ruthless in a corporate world ruled by men. At night, he taught me the art of love. I'm a product of Benedict Singer, his creation.
Does he allow you to see other men?
I've fucked other men, if that's what you mean, but only for business. Benedict's not crazy about sharing his toys unless he gets something back.
She looked at him with a sad smile.
I've never been in love, in case you were wondering. Never had the chance.
Why did you change your last name to Singer?
Benedict's idea. He knew his men would respect me more as Celeste Singer than Celeste Alexeyev.
She signaled the waiter for another drink.
Now you talk. I heard you were once one of the top deep-sea submersible pilots in the world until the Navy accident in the Mariana Trench.
Jonas shot her an icy glare.
Darling, give us a little credit. We did a thorough check on every principal involved with the Tanaka Institute before agreeing to buy in. You'd be surprised what we know.
That was a different life. My piloting days are long over.
I just told you my deepest, darkest secrets. Now I want to know. What happened to that cocky young submersible pilot I remember seeing on PBS when I was 17?
Oh, Christ, now I really do feel old.
Come on.
He leaned forward. About 11 years ago, I was piloting a 3-man submersible for the Navy. It was a top-secret dive almost 7 miles down in the Mariana Trench. I was tired. It was my third dive in a week, and I knew I shouldn't have been down there, but they had no one else. It's a long 5-hour descent in total darkness, so your mind tends to wander. I remember staring into the pitch, several thousand feet from the bottom, when a white glow appeared, then disappeared before my eyes. The other two scientists on board saw nothing. I continued watching, when all of a sudden this monstrous white head appears out of nowhere, rising out of the abyss. The megalodon? At the time, I had never even heard of a megalodon. All I knew was that we were about to die. So I jettisoned all of our weight plates and raced the sub to the surface. On the way up, something went wrong within the dive pod and we lost pressurization. One man hit his head, rupturing a blood vessel in his brain. He bled to death before we hit the surface. The other man died in sick bay. I spent 3 weeks recovering, then was shipped to a psychiatric ward for evaluation. That's where I met Mac.
So you changed your career?
Yes. For the next 7 years, I became consumed with trying to prove to myself and everyone around me that the creature really existed, that it wasn't some aberration of the deep like the Navy said. So I gave up piloting submersibles, the one thing I truly loved, to become a paleobiologist.
But you went back down. You proved everyone wrong.
I was foolhardy. I allowed my ego and emotions to impair my judgment. Meg or no Meg, entering the abyss in a 1-man submersible was just plain stupid. Maseo Tanaka convinced me to go. He needed me to escort his son into the trench to retrieve a damaged Eunice robot. I let him talk me into it. Hell, the truth is, I wanted to go.
And you ran into the creature again?
2 of them. The first attacked us, killing Tanaka's son. It became entangled in the submersible's cable, and the surface ship unknowingly began hauling it topside. And then a second creature appeared, a larger female, who began devouring its helpless mate, ascending through the icy waters in the warmth of the dead male's blood.
Angel's mother?
Jonas nodded. Attempting to capture the megalodon instead of killing her was the biggest mistake I made.
Nonsense. If it wasn't for you, we wouldn't have our star attraction. You're responsible for the greatest show on Earth.
What I'm responsible for is a lot of innocent people dying, like those three boys. Jonas felt his patience wearing thin. Celeste, I need to know. Are you going to reinforce the gateway or not?
Tomorrow you'll determine if the doors are being damaged. Tonight, we'll get better acquainted.
She slipped off her sandal and rubbed his leg again with her toes. Jonas stood. Since you've already checked me out thoroughly, I think I'd prefer a good night's sleep. Do svidaniya. Celeste swore under her breath as Jonas headed out the door. Tokamak. Western Pacific Ocean. Terry kicked the sheets away in frustration. Despite having gone to bed more than 3 hours ago, she could not sleep, her concern over her father refusing to allow her mind to rest. She looked at the digital clock, 2:38 a.m. The hell with it. She climbed out of her cot and unlatched the cabin's porthole, breathing in the brisk night air. Go for a walk, clear your mind, and cool off. She slipped into her jogging suit and opened the door to her cabin, carrying her tennis shoes in hand. Barefoot, she entered the deserted corridor, emerging 5 minutes later on the starboard deck of the Goliath. She pulled her shoes on and began walking at a brisk pace. A tapestry of stars sparkled against a black velvet sky, soothing her soul. Unexpectedly, an ocean breeze whipped across the deck, sending shivers down her spine, breaking the trance. Pulling the jogging suit up around her ears, she stared at the Goliath's pyramid-like superstructure rising above her head, and listened to the cold wind as it howled through the maze of steel. She passed a steel turret, the remains of what had been the missile cruiser's 30-millimeter Gatling guns. Continuing forward, she crossed the wide-open space of deck leading to the Goliath's massive bow, the only visible structure being a series of steel hatches that had once covered several dozen missile silos. Terry leaned against the bow's guardrail, staring at the lead-gray sea. 4 years ago, her brother, DJ, had descended into the trench with Jonas, only to be devoured by a species of shark. Her family now earned a living exploiting. She and her brother had been so close. How could so much have changed so quickly? The wind blew tears across her face. She thought about her father, how the last few years had aged him. The Tanaka Lagoon had been his life's dream, an aquarium so large that a pod of whales could swim in and out without restriction. Not only would the facility never house a single cetacean, but financial difficulties over the Megalodon's capture had forced her father to turn over control of his organization to Benedict Singer. It had been the final straw that had crushed his spirit. She thought about Jonas, realizing she'd probably been a bit harsh. Her husband had suffered as much as anyone, yet for some reason her love for him had grown cold over the last year. Deep down she knew she still blamed him for the loss of her stillborn, as well as her father's diminishing health. She wondered if their relationship was salvageable. Terry's teeth began chattering from the cold. Turning to head back, she heard the sound of hydraulics coming from one of the steel hatches. Ducking behind a wall of stacked life rafts, she watched three men in white lab coats emerge from what appeared to be a stairwell built within one of the missile silos. The men stretched, inhaling the night air as if they had been below for quite some time. Terry heard dialogue that sounded Russian. One of the men removed a bottle of vodka from his lab coat, took a massive swig, then offered the bottle to his comrades. They waved him off, heading aft without him. The man with the vodka spotted the stacks of life rafts. Barely able to stand, he removed a small device from his breast pocket and aimed it at the open stairwell, swearing aloud until the hatch sealed. Then he drained the remains of the bottle and staggered toward the spot where Terry was hiding. She moved to the opposite side of the stack, remaining out of sight. The Russian collapsed on deck, leaning back against one of the life rafts. Several minutes passed. The man began snoring. Terry emerged from hiding and leaned over him, gagging at his breath. She stared at the hideous scar slicing horizontally across the base of the man's throat. Then she noticed the remote control device in his hand. Gently, she pried open his fingers. The man stirred. She froze as he opened his eyes halfway and flashed her a drunken smile.
«У меня тазнит!»
He passed out. Terry removed the device from his hand and looked around. The foredeck was deserted. Moving to the sealed hatch, she pressed the green button on the remote control. The hatch lifted, revealing a steel stairwell that disappeared below deck. A shot of adrenaline coursed through her. She recalled the words she had spoken only days ago to her father. "Dad, how much do you trust Singer?" Descending several steps, she turned around and pressed the red button, sealing the hatch behind her. The hum of a powerful generator filled her ears, the noise coming from somewhere down below. She descended two flights of stairs, coming to a sealed door. Terry released the latches along either side of the watertight door and pulled it open, revealing a brightly lit antiseptic white corridor. She secured the door behind her and moved quickly down the passageway. At the end of the hall was an imposing steel security door. She felt disappointed, realizing that a personal identification card was necessary in order to enter. Swearing under her breath, she turned to head back down the corridor when a loud buzz startled her. The hydraulic door began opening outward.
Oh, shit, what have you gotten yourself into?
Totally exposed, with no time to flee, Terry squeezed out of sight behind the steel door as it swung open with a metallic hiss. She flattened herself against the adjacent wall, the back of the door pressing tightly against her face and chest. She heard men's voices speaking in an Arabic dialect, diminishing as they continued down the corridor. Terry felt the security door crushing her ribcage when the pressure ceased, the door retreating away from her face. Without hesitation, she slipped inside, the door locking into place behind her. She had entered a large lounge. To her left, several chairs and sofas faced a big-screen television and VCR. To her right, a kitchenette with sink, microwave, and refrigerator. Directly ahead was a closed door. She pulled it open gently. A blast of humidity hit her square in the face. To her surprise, she found herself standing in a large locker room. Sinks and toilets to her left, lockers on the right. A passage leading into the showers directly ahead. She heard men's voices in the showers. Terry exited the locker room, only to hear the familiar buzz of the steel security door reopening. Racing back into the locker room, she ducked into one of the toilet stalls and locked the door. Heart racing, she sat on the seat, drawing her feet up to her chest, praying that no one would notice her. Several minutes passed. Terry heard the slapping of bare feet against tile. Peering through the crack between the door and frame, she saw a naked man standing directly in front of her stall, facing the sinks. Dark complexioned, with thick mats of black hair along his back, he turned on the water and proceeded to shave. Another man spoke to him in Arabic from the changing area. The Arab finished shaving and moved out of sight. The men continued speaking, occasionally laughing. Moments later, Terry heard them exit the locker room through the lounge door. She waited another few minutes. Then, drenched in sweat, she opened the stall door and tiptoed out of the bathroom. The locker room was empty, but she could hear the television playing in the lounge.
Damn.
Trapped, she walked past the shower stalls, entering a small alcove ending at a watertight door mounted within a framework of rubber insulation. Above the door was a white sign with red lettering, its message written in English, Russian, German, and Arabic. Warning, all personnel must shower before entering lab. Terry pulled hard on the door, which opened outward, a powerful hiss of air pushing at her back. What kind of lab is designed to prevent air from escaping? Is Benedict dealing with viruses? She stepped into an antechamber, which appeared to be a changing area. White tile lined the floor, walls, and ceiling. Stacks of fresh towels sat on shelves above two large laundry baskets and a row of benches. Suspended from hooks were dozens of pressurized bodysuits. At the end of the room was another pressurized door with a warning sign posted above it. No one may enter Tokamak Lab without a pressurized suit. Sweat poured down her face, her nerves quivering from the tension. She swore at herself, wishing she had remained in her room. She also realized she should have urinated while in the bathroom stall.
You came this far, finish it.
Searching the rack, she located one of the smaller pressurized suits and laid it on the ground. Removing her shoes, she stepped into the suit, slipping her feet into the attached rubber boots. Pulling the rest of the bulky suit onto her shoulders, she tucked her shoes into her jogging suit pockets, then slid her arms into the sleeves, struggling to push her fingers all the way into the attached rubber gloves. Terry reached behind her neck and pulled the hooded headpiece into place, then zipped the front of the suit up. A popping sound filled her ears. The faceplate steamed up, blinding her. She unzipped the suit, gasping, then noticed an orange hose attached to a machine along one wall. Resealing the zipper, she grabbed the end of the hose and connected it to a valve on her suit. A rush of air filled her ears as the suit inflated around her, clearing her faceplate. She detached the hose, then opened the pressurized door and stepped inside. Terry gawked at her new surroundings. She was on a narrow catwalk, towering 5 stories above a vast interior that spanned the entire forward compartment of the Goliath. What had once been vertical launching silos had been gutted out, creating a 10,000-square-foot high-tech chamber, the centerpiece of which was an enormous object, shaped like a giant metallic ring. Terry gripped the rail in front of her, unsure of what to do next. 2 technicians exited the strange object. Both wore pressurized suits and air tanks. One looked up in her direction. Terry waved, and they moved on. She proceeded down the spiral flight of stairs, wondering how she had gotten herself into this mess. She approached the donut-shaped vacuum chamber, an enormous circular tube of steel towering 20 feet above the floor. Thick copper coils encircled its outer hull. Numerous cables ran from the machine, attaching to computer terminals and high-tech equipment situated around the perimeter. Within the farther recesses of the lab were massive generators, their deep thrumming sounds causing the steel floor to vibrate beneath her feet. Terry looked around. The two technicians were nowhere to be seen. She located a computer terminal whose monitor was on and sat down, engaging the mouse. A program menu appeared. GTI Tokamak. Alpha Particles. H-Mode. Magnetic Well. Neutron Energy Absorber. Passive Safety Systems. Primary Transformer. Superconducting Magnets. Target Chamber. Turbulence. Electromagnetic Force. Ionization Chamber. Neutral Beam Injectors. Particle and Cell, PIC, Program. Colloidal field plasma current. Reactor fuels, deuterium, tritium. Toroidal field coils, vacuum vessel. Terry looked up from the monitor. The technicians had returned and were staring at her from across the room. One motioned to the other. They approached. Terry stood, realizing that the air within her pressurized suit was diminishing. Walking casually toward the spiral staircase, she kept her head low to hide her face. The men followed her. Nearing the stairs, she broke into a run, climbing two steps at a time. Men's voices shouted in her headpiece, first in Russian, then in English.
Whoever you are, stop now! Identify yourself!
Terry reached the catwalk, out of breath. She lunged for the pressurized door, her pursuers gaining on her. Passing through the changing area, she reached the pressurized door and pulled it open, stumbling awkwardly into the showers, her rubber boots skidding out from under her. She fell hard onto her back and slid across the wet floor. Russian voices filled her ears. Get up, girl! Move your ass! Regaining her feet, Terry ran into the lounge. Four men, all dressed in surgical gowns, looked up from the television. Concealing her face with her gloved hands, Terry darted through the lounge to the security door, searching desperately for the means of opening it. She located a green button and pushed it as the Russian technicians came bolting out of the locker room. Terry squeezed through the door and ran through the connecting corridor. She pushed open the watertight door and ducked inside, smashing her forehead painfully against the steel casing. Slamming the door closed behind her, she secured the latches as the Russian voices grew louder in her ears. As she dragged herself up two flights of stairs, Terry began stripping the pressurized suit from her body. Her lungs ached from the physical exertion. Her heart pounded in her ears. At the top of the stairs, she reached for the remote control in her jogging suit, groaning as she felt it slip into her right boot. Terry could hear the Russian technicians panting in the headpiece's earphones. Pulling her legs free of the pressurized suit, she reached into the boot for the remote, then pressed the green button. The hatch swung open above her head. The Russians pushed through the watertight door, ascending the stairs as Terry emerged on deck. She turned and sealed the hatch behind her, still dragging the pressurized suit. The trunk. She ran to the life rafts, relieved to find the man passed out on deck. She pulled his shoes off, then shoved his feet into the boots, working the suit up his back. She heard the hatch opening. Terry shoved the man's arms roughly into the suit's sleeves as a half-dozen men emerged from the open hatch. She ducked behind the pile of rafts and looked around desperately. The foredeck was all open space. With nowhere to hide, she ran across the deck to the rail and climbed over, clenching the lowest of the three bars as she dangled precariously along the Goliath's outer hull, 40 feet above the dark Pacific. Men shouted. They had found the drunk. Terry pressed her bare feet against the cool steel plates. Hand over hand, she made her way aft along the hull. Her goal? To make it to an immense steel turret, all that remained of one of the missile cruiser's big guns. Her hands and feet were numb, her fingers too small to wrap completely around the rail. After 20 feet, she had to stop. Pulling herself up, she squeezed between the railing, hearing men running on deck. Terry crawled along the outside of the turret, remaining out of sight. Now only 40 feet of open deck lay between her and the ship's superstructure. Crawling on hands and knees, she reached the maze of steel and climbed up to the next deck. Hearing activity below, she entered the ship, then ascended another level. 5 minutes later, she arrived at the entrance to C-deck. Hearing voices, she peered around the corridor. Benedict Singer was in his bathrobe, speaking with the two Russian technicians from the lab. They were standing in front of her stateroom, glancing at her door. Terry hurried back outside and crawled along a narrow deck situated beneath her cabin. Looking up, she verified that the porthole of her stateroom was still open. Okay, you can do this. She jumped, wincing as her raw, numb fingers gained a grip along the outer edge of the open porthole. Pushing her feet against the rail to gain leverage, she shoved her head through the hole, the rest of her body still dangling outside. Her shoulders were too wide to squeeze through. She heard a knock on the door. Terry pulled her head out, slid one arm through the porthole, then pushed her head back through the opening. Wiggling and twisting her shoulders, she managed to squeeze inside, falling headfirst in a heap on the cabin floor. The knock came again, this time louder, more urgent.
Just a minute.
Terry closed the porthole, then stripped off her jogging suit. Naked, she tore a sheet off the bed and wrapped herself in it, concealing her bleeding fingers and dirty feet. She opened the door, feigning grogginess.
Is it time to leave already?
Benedict and the two technicians looked at her.
No, my dear, not yet, Benedict said. We had a little disturbance earlier and just wanted to make sure you were all right.
What kind of disturbance? His penetrating emerald eye shot Terry an icy glare, then caught sight of the back wall.
It's not important. Go back to bed.
Terry gave him a tired smile and closed the door. She paused to listen, hearing Benedict spout orders in Russian to his men before closing his own door. Satisfied, she limped over to her bed. She was cold, sore, and felt utterly exhausted. What was Benedict hiding? Too tired to care, she lay down, smiling at her own daring. Just before drifting off, she reached for a pen and pad of paper off the night table. She scrawled the word Tuckamack, then tore away the sheet, crumpling the paper into one of her shoes. A minute later, she fell into a restless sleep, unaware of the trail of black fingerprints she had left along the porthole wall. Unhinged. Tanaka Oceanographic Institute, Monterey, California.
Did I mention that you're out of your mind?
Yes, Mac, several times. Cut the engines. I don't want to spook the Meg.
Spook the Meg? Fuck the Meg, pal. You're spooking the shit out of me.
Mac switched off the mercury outboard, allowing the 30-foot pontoon to drift toward the outer edge of the canal seawall. He reached out and grabbed the exposed ledge of the submerged concrete barrier, securing the flat-bottomed vessel against it. The design of the ocean access canal consisted of an 80-foot deep-dredged channel bordered by two concrete seawalls running parallel to each other, 60 feet apart. Running from the western wall of the lagoon, the canal extended like a highway off-ramp across a short stretch of beach, continuing out into the Pacific another 1,000 feet. The 80-foot-high steel doors that sealed the canal were positioned at the three-quarter mark, 750 feet offshore. During low tides, the upper 2 to 3 feet of seawall were visible, resembling a narrow sidewalk running into the sea. But at high tide, the wall became submerged, its presence identifiable only by a dozen orange buoys and signs warning trespassers away. Jonas pointed to a double helix of barbed wire mounted between the two seawalls. The barbed wire marks the location of the gateway.
Christ, here she comes, said Mac.
An 8-foot wake surged through the canal, heading for the barbed wire. With a resounding boom, the creature struck the doors, the impact unleashing powerful reverberations along both seawalls. Mac rubbed his hands nervously across his crew cut.
Damn, Jonas, are we safe sitting here?
That's what I intend to find out.
You'll be sure to let me know before your fish escapes, right? Just out of curiosity, which way were those gates designed to swing open?
Fortunately, from the outside in. Maceo originally designed them to lure migrating pregnant humpbacks and greys into the lagoon to breed. The doors are porous, so ocean water moves freely back and forth into the tank. The distant sound of timpani drums echoed across the canal.
Afternoon show's getting ready to start, Jonas said. I'd better get my gear on.
Mac watched his friend squeeze into the neoprene wetsuit.
Jonas, I know life's been shitting on your head of late, but what you're about to do, well, it's just fucking dangerous.
If you know of another way to assess the damage to the gate, I'm all ears.
The squawk of the walkie-talkie interrupted them.
Go ahead, Manny.
Doc, we just increased the underwater acoustics. I'll let you know the moment she enters the canal.
Thanks.
The drums grew louder. Jonas realized his heart was beating in sync with the voodoo-like cadence.
Jonas, we've been friends for, what, 11 years now, right? You know you're my closest friend.
Here I thought I was your only friend, Jonas smiled.
What's on your mind?
Well, actually, it's what's on your mind that worries me. Terry's right. You become obsessed with this damn monster. Haven't you had enough?
Jonas stared across the beachhead, focusing on the packed open-air arena.
More than enough. Then get out. I'll bet these nightmares of yours go away within a week after you leave the Institute.
I plan to very soon. First, there's still a 31-ton loose end I need to tend to.
Do you have that transmitter?
Right here.
Mac removed a 6-inch dart-like object from a tackle box. The casing of the object was no wider than a bullet. A 4-inch barbed harpoon protruded from one end.
Seems kind of small. What's its range?
Well, it varies depending on ocean depth and topography. Figure 300 to 500 miles. It emits a subaudible acoustic signal that can be instantly identified by SOSIS, allowing you to track your monster anywhere in the world.
Jonas inspected the instrument, impressed. SOSIS was the Navy's $15 billion underwater sound surveillance system, which for decades had been used exclusively to track enemy ships and submarines.
Consisting of more than 30,000 miles of undersea cable and microphones, the global array was now used by scientists to listen to whale song, monitor seaquakes, or detect icebergs cracking apart from thousands of miles away. Jonas handed the dart back to Mac. How long will the batteries last?
Well, the transmitter contains a lithium primary battery along with a nickel-cadmium booster. You should be good for up to 6 months.
Where's the gun? Mac removed a small handgun resembling a starter's pistol from his jacket. He screwed a plastic adapter into the end of the barrel, then loaded the transmitter within the adapter, handing it to Jonas.
For a handgun, this weapon carries quite a kick. Be sure to aim and fire using both hands. Unfortunately, the gun only has an effective range of about 100 yards. Beyond that, I doubt the transmitter would be able to pierce the megalodon's thick hide. If you give me another 2 weeks, I can come up with something that would attach to a rifle.
We don't have that much time. I want a tagger today.
Doc, come in.
Jonas grabbed the walkie-talkie. Go ahead, Manny.
Angel just entered the lagoon. If you're going to do this, you'd better move.
Jonas grabbed his fins. Keep the boat here. I don't want the Meg to see it when she returns. After I inspect the hinges, we'll pull up along the outside of the canal and tag her.
Yeah, whatever. Hey, Jonas, you know what the definition of a shithead is?
Jonas positioned his face mask, staring into the blue water.
No, what? A shithead's a guy who sees a pile of shit on the ground, knows it's shit, but steps in it anyway. Go play with your fucking shark, shithead.
Jonas looked back at his friend, then stepped off the boat. He plunged feet first, a curtain of bubbles momentarily blinding him as he fell into the turbid green waters. Leveling out at 30 feet, he remained close to the interior of the seawall on his right, the concrete facing camouflaged behind a slick layer of vegetation. A strong current pushed him through the channel. Within moments, he was at the gate. Looming out of the misty blue sea, a pair of sealed steel doors dwarfed his presence. Dark and ominous, the submerged barrier ran as far as his eyes could see, disappearing 80 feet into the murk below. A thin veil of rust and barnacles ran along the sheer wall of metal. Jonas reached out and poked 3 fingers inside one of the pores, a good 5 inches of steel. Unable to resist, he peered through the 3-inch opening, staring at the other side of the canal. A chill ran down his spine. Stop wasting time, shithead. Jonas approached the seawall to his right and switched on his powerful underwater light. He aimed the beacon at the hinges that connected the doorframe to the concrete canal wall. The damage began 10 feet down, becoming more pronounced as he descended. The 3-foot steel hinges had already started buckling outward under the force of the creature's head-on blows. Although they remained in place, Jonas knew it would only be a matter of time until the joints were torn free. Once the first few went, the rest would follow quickly. He set off to inspect the other door when a flash of movement caught his eye. 15 feet below, a broad lead-gray back glided silently along the gateway. Reaching the concrete seawall, it banked sharply, disappearing in the murk. Jonas turned his head. From out of the mist, a second shark emerged directly ahead of him. A wave of adrenaline washed over him. It was another great white, very large, an 18-footer, well over a ton. Fighting to remain calm, Jonas sculled backward until his air tank clanked against the steel gate. The 18-footer continued moving toward him slowly. Horizontal pectoral fins flared like mid-wings on a jet fighter. The great white closed to within 20 feet, homing in on his scent. Jonas directed his light forward, the beam illuminating dark holes peppering the underside of the shark's snout. The ampullae of Lorenzini. The predator was zooming in on the faint electrical field given off by his pounding heart. Jonas waved his arms wildly, yelling into his regulator. The shark closed to within 4 feet, then veered off, the big male showing Jonas its twin claspers. He looked down. 3 more sharks circled below, all great whites. Jonas remained frozen against the steel door. 2 more predators crossed his vision in front, both males. So many of them, all males. Why are they here? The sharks began circling faster, clearly becoming agitated. One of the larger animals lashed out at a competitor. For a heart-stopping moment, the 2 whites tore into one another's thick hides, 4,000 pounds of muscle twisting and writhing as one before separating. Jonas had never witnessed behavior like this among Carcharodon carcharias. He felt incredibly vulnerable, a lone sheep among hungry wolves. He checked his depth. 60 feet. Jonas flattened himself against the steel door, minimizing himself as a target. It didn't work. The sharks began their attack. Mac couldn't see the show in the lagoon, but knew what was happening by the crowd's reaction. Minutes passed. What the hell was taking Jonas so long? A 3-foot charcoal dorsal fin shot past the boat, its caudal fin slapping along the surface. Mac watched it move into the canal before realizing what he had just seen.
God damn it, Jonas!
Mac gunned the engine, accelerating through the canal toward the barbed wire barrier. A second dorsal fin appeared to his left, then another. Frantic, he searched the surface for air bubbles. He looked up at the last second. Too late.
Fuck me!
Mac slammed the throttle into reverse, sending a suffocating cloud of blue smoke into his face. Caught in its own wake, the boat surged forward, the flat bow sliding beneath the spiral barrier, lodging itself in the barbed wire.
Stupid fucking asshole!
Mac grabbed an oar and pushed against the fencing, desperate to free the boat. Movement ahead caused him to look up. An 8-foot wake curled out of the lagoon, bearing down on him. Jonah saw Mac's boat. He began ascending, frantically looking in all directions as the sharks took turns making runs at him. He paused again at 35 feet. A 1,600-pound flesh-seeking missile glided in on him, slowing as it neared the wall. Jonas knew the sharks' ampullae of Lorenzini were being scrambled by the fluctuating AC fields given off by the hydraulic steel doors. Closing within 10 feet, the great white's remarkable sensory system became confused. Rather than retreat, the prodigious predator opened its gruesome mouth, extending its jaws and scalpel-sharp ivory teeth, rolling its black eyes back into its head. Having lost sight of its prey, its receptor system temporarily disoriented, the great white struck the wall to Jonas's right, opening and closing its hideous mouth in powerful, gnashing bites as it blindly searched for its meal along the steel door. Quickly, Jonas released air from his BCD vest, sinking beneath the oncoming mouth. The monster's head passed directly over him, its jaws continuing to open and close as it slid its face sideways along the gate. The 15-foot male gave up and retreated back into the mist. Jonas scissors kicked, ascending to 30 feet. He looked down. Another male, the 20-footer, rising directly beneath him. Jonas kicked harder. The slack jaw opened, black eyes rolled back, ivory teeth distended, and Jonas knew the beast had him. The shark struck him with the force of a small truck, its mouth engulfing his left leg up to his hip. Jonas bit through his regulator and tongue, his body sizzling as if hit by a live wire. He lashed downward with his left hand, striking the shark squarely on its snout with the blunt end of his flashlight. The jaws opened. Jonas paddled, twisting to squirm his leg from the terrible mouth. The big male paused, shook its head, then was upon him again, jaws stretched open. It turned and darted away. Jonas registered the luminescent white glow, followed by a deafening explosion of metal, as the megalodon struck the steel doors like an 18-wheeler hitting a police barricade. The impacted door slammed hard into Jonas's air tank, driving the breath from his chest as the tanks exploded in his ears. A horrible screech of metal echoed all around him as the face of the steel door continued to open, thrusting him face first toward the seawall. The monstrous girth of the megalodon pushed its way through the widening gap. The ruptured tank, now emptied of air, pulled Jonas down like an anchor. Blinded, with his mask hopelessly flooded, he gagged on a mouthful of water as he continued to sink out of control, unable to kick with his lacerated leg. Pony bottle. Jonas tore the small cylinder of air from his belt, exhaled, then sucked in a life-giving lungful of air. Struggling to locate the latch of his weight belt, and blinded by his own blood, Jonas reached around his waist, feeling his lower body going numb. Finally, he managed to grab the plastic latch and pull. The weight belt slid away, smashing his mutilated leg on its way to the bottom. He began rising in a mist of blood that seemed to hover along the facing of the mangled steel door. Jonas cleared his mask and felt woozy from the effort. Realizing he was moments from passing out and bleeding to death, he focused on swimming to the surface, then stopped, looking into the face of his worst nightmare. Angel's gray eye was staring at him, her luminescent head less than 15 feet away. The demonic smile, slightly agape, opened and closed in small spasms, as if talking to him. Jonas froze, absolutely terrified. Blackness started closing in on his vision. Angel remained motionless before him, momentarily sizing him up. She recognizes me. Jonas felt himself rising. His left hand reached out, touching the unhinged steel door. Move! In one adrenaline-enhanced muscular contraction, Jonas pulled himself behind the mangled door, squeezing between the torn-off hinges. A split second before his angel of death launched her open jaws upon him. The megalodon's snout smashed into the inner facing of the door, driving it back against the concrete seawall. Jonas heard the steel door groan at his back, shielding him from Angel's jaws. Too weak to care, he shut his eyes and continued rising through the trail of his own blood, buoyed by what little air remained in his BCD vest. Max stood over the engine mount, staring into the swirling green waters. He knew the megalodon had bludgeoned its way through the gate. What he didn't know was whether Jonas was still alive. an alabaster glow appeared. The dorsal fin broke the surface, moving out to sea. Mac aimed the pistol with two hands and fired. The dart struck the base of the dorsal fin. And then something struck the bottom of the pontoon boat with a thud. Mac ran to the noise. Ahead, Bob.